into the warm apartment. She undressed and climbed into a hot bath. As she soaked in the water, letting the heat take away the lingering cold, she rested a hand on her belly. She could feel the slight swelling there. She closed her eyes and tried to feel the little one that was inside. There wasn't much time left. Somehow she had to let Tengo know that she was carrying his child, and that she would fight desperately to protect it. She dressed, got into bed, lay on her side in the dark, and fell asleep. Before she fell into a deep sleep, she had a short dream about the dowager. Almam is in the greenhouse at the Willow House as they watch butterflies together. The greenhouse is like a womb, dim and warm. The rubber tree she left behind in her old apartment is there. It has been well taken care of and is so green that she hardly recognizes it. A butterfly from a southern land that she has never seen before is resting on one of its thick leaves. The butterfly has folded its brightly colored wings and seems to be sleeping peacefully. Ah, Mama is happy about this. In the dream, her belly is hugely swollen. It seems near her due date. She can make out the heartbeat of the little one. Her heartbeat and that of the little one blend together into a pleasant joint rhythm. The dowager is seated beside her, her back ramrod straight as always, her lips in a straight line quietly breathing. The two of them don't talk, in order not to wake the sleeping butterfly. The dowager is detached, as if she doesn't notice that Almama is next to her. Almama, of course, knows how closely the dowager protects her, but even so, she can't shake a sense of unease. The dowager's hands in her lap are too thin and fragile. Almama's hands unconsciously feel for the pistol, but can't find it. She is swallowed up by the dream, yet at the same time aware it is a dream. Sometimes Almama has those kinds of dreams where she is in a distinct, vivid reality, but knows it isn't real. It is a detailed scene from a small planet somewhere else. In the dream, someone opens the door to the greenhouse. An ominous cold wind blows in. The large butterfly opens its eyes, spreads its wings, and flutters off, away from the rubber tree. Who is it? She twists her head to look in that direction. But before she can see who it is, the dream is over. She was sweating when she woke up, an unpleasant, clammy sweat. She stripped off her damp pajamas, dried herself with a towel, and put on a new t-shirt. She sat up in bed for a time. Something bad might be about to happen. Somebody might be trying to get the little one, and whoever that is might be very close by. She had to find Tengo. There was not a moment to lose. But other than watching the playground every night, there wasn't a thing she could do. Nothing other than what she was already doing, carefully, patiently, dutifully, keeping her eyes open, trained on this one tiny section of the world, that single point at the top of the slide. Even with such focus, though, a person can overlook things, because she only has one pair of eyes. Almama wanted to cry, but the tears wouldn't come. She lay down again in bed, rested her palms on her stomach, and quietly waited for sleep to overtake her.
Chapter 18. Tengo. When you prick a person with a needle, red blood comes out. Nothing happened for 3 days after that, Komatsu said. I ate the food they gave me, slept at night in the narrow little bed, woke up when morning came, and used the small toilet in one corner of the room. The toilet had a partition for privacy, but no lock on it. There was still a lot of residual summer heat at the time, but the ventilator shaft seemed to be connected to an AC, so it didn't feel hot. Tengo listened to Komatsu's story without comment. They brought me food 3 times a day. At what time, I don't know. They took my watch away, and the room didn't have a window, so I didn't even know if it was day or night. I listened carefully, but couldn't hear a sound. I doubt anyone could hear any sound from me. I had no idea where they had taken me, though I did have a vague sense that we were somewhere off the beaten track. Anyhow, I was there for 3 days, and nothing happened. I'm not actually certain it was 3 days. They brought me 9 meals altogether, and I ate them when they brought them. The lights in the room were turned out 3 times, and I slept 3 times. Usually I'm a light, irregular sleeper, but for some reason I slept like a log. It's kind of strange if you think about it. Do you follow me so far? Tengo silently nodded. I didn't say a word for the entire 3 days. A young man brought my meals. He was thin and had on a baseball cap and a white medical face mask. He wore a kind of sweatshirt and sweatpants and dirty sneakers. He brought my meals on a tray and then took them away when I was finished. They used paper plates and flimsy plastic knives, forks, and spoons. The food they brought was ordinary prepared food in silver foil packages. Not very good, but not so bad you wouldn't eat it. They didn't bring much each meal, and I was hungry, so I ate every bite. That was kind of weird, too. Usually I don't have much of an appetite, and if I'm not careful, sometimes I even forget to eat. They gave me milk and mineral water to drink. They didn't provide coffee or tea, no single malt whiskey or draft beer, no smokes either. But what are you going to do? Wasn't like I was lounging around some nice hotel. As if he had just remembered that now he could smoke at his leisure, Komatsu pulled out another red Marlboro pack, stuck a cigarette between his lips, and lit it with a paper match. He sucked the smoke deep into his lungs, exhaled, and then frowned. The man who brought the meals never said a word. He must have been ordered by his superiors not to say anything. I'm sure he was at the bottom of the totem pole, a kind of all-purpose gopher. I think he must have been trained in one of the martial arts, though. He had a sort of focus to the way he carried himself. You didn't ask him anything? I knew that if I spoke to him, he wouldn't respond, so I just kept quiet and let things be. I ate the food they brought me, drank my milk, went to bed when they turned out the lights, woke up when they turned them back on. In the morning, the young guy would come and bring me an electric razor and toothbrush, and I would shave and brush my teeth. When I was done, he would take them back. Other than toilet paper, there was nothing else to speak of in the room. They didn't let me take a shower or change my clothes, but I never felt like taking a shower or changing. There was no mirror in the room, but that didn't bother me. The worst thing was definitely the boredom. I mean, from the time I woke up till the time I went to sleep, I had to sit there, alone, not speaking to anyone, in this white, completely square, dice-like room. I was bored to tears. I'm kind of a print junkie. I always need to have something to read with me. A room service menu, you name it. But I didn't have any books, newspapers, or magazines. No TV or radio. No games. No one to talk to. Nothing to do but sit in the chair and stare at the floor, the walls, the ceiling. It was a totally absurd feeling. I mean, you're walking down the road when some people jump out of nowhere, grab you, put chloroform or something over your nose, drag you off somewhere, and hold you in a strange, windowless little room. A weird situation, no matter how you cut it. And you get so bored you think you're going to lose your mind. Komatsu stared with deep feeling at the cigarette between his fingers, the smoke curling up, then flicked the ash into the ashtray. I think they must have thrown me into that tiny room for 3 days with nothing to do, trying to get me to break down. They seemed to know what they were doing when it came to breaking a person's spirit, pushing someone to the edge. On the 4th day, after I had my 4th breakfast, in other words, 2 other men came in. I figured this was the pair that had kidnapped me. I was attacked so suddenly that I didn't get a good look at their faces. But when I saw them on the 4th day, it started to come back to me, how they had pulled me into the car so roughly that I thought they were going to twist my arm off. how they had stuffed a cloth soaked with some kind of drug on my nose and mouth. The two of them didn't say a word the whole time, and it was over in an instant. Remembering the events, Komatsu frowned. One of them wasn't very tall, but he was solidly built, with a buzz cut. He had a deep tan and prominent cheekbones. The other one was tall, with long limbs, sunken cheeks, his hair tied up behind him in a ponytail. Put them side by side, and they looked like a comedy team. You've got your tall, thin one, and your short, stocky one with a goatee. But I could tell at a glance these were no comedians. They were a dangerous pair. They would never hesitate to do whatever had to be done, without making a big scene. They acted very relaxed, which made them all the more scary, and their eyes were frighteningly cold. They both wore black cotton trousers and white short-sleeved shirts. They were probably in their mid to late 20s. The bald one may be a little older than the other one. Neither one wore a watch. Tengo was silent, waiting for him to go on. Buzzcut did all the talking. Ponytail just stood there in front of the door, ramrod straight, without moving a muscle. It seemed like he was listening to our conversation, but then again, maybe not. Buzzcut sat down right across from me in a folding metal chair he had brought, and talked. There were no other chairs, so I sat on the bed. The guy had no facial expression at all. His mouth moved when he spoke, but other than that, his face was frozen, like a ventriloquist's dummy. The first thing Buzzcut said when he sat down across from Komatsu was this. "Are you able to guess who we are and why we brought you here?"
"No, I can't," Komatsu replied.
Buzzcut stared at Komatsu for a while with his depthless eyes. "But say you had to make a guess," he went on. "What would you say?" His words were polite enough, but his tone was forceful, his voice as hard and cold as a metal ruler left for a long time in a fridge. Komatsu hesitated, but then said honestly that if he were forced to make a guess, he would say it had something to do with the Air Chrysalis affair. Nothing else came to mind. "That would mean you two are probably from Sakigake," he continued, "and we are in your compound." Buzzcut neither confirmed nor denied what Komatsu had said. He just stared at him. Komatsu kept silent as well.
"Let's talk, then, based on that hypothesis," Buzzcut quietly began. "What we're going to say from now on is an extension of that hypothesis of yours, all based on the assumption that this is indeed the case. Is that acceptable?"
"That would be fine," Komatsu replied. They were going to talk about this as indirectly as they could. This was not a bad sign. If they were planning not to let him out of here alive, they wouldn't go to the trouble.
"As an editor at a publishing house, you are in charge of publishing Eriko Fukada's Air Chrysalis. Am I correct?"
"You are," Komatsu admitted. This was common knowledge.
"Based on our understanding, there was some fraud involved in the publication. Air Chrysalis received a literary prize for debut novelists from a literary journal, but before the selection committee received the manuscript, a third party rewrote it considerably at your direction. After the work was secretly revised, it won the prize, was published as a book, and became a bestseller. Do I have my facts correct?"
"It depends on how you look at it," Komatsu said. "There are times when a submitted manuscript is rewritten on advice of the editor."
Buzzcut put his hand up to cut him off.
"There's nothing dishonest about the author revising parts of the novel based on the editor's advice. You're right. But having a third party rewrite the work is unscrupulous. Not only that, but forming a phony company to distribute royalties. I don't know how this would be interpreted from a legal standpoint, but morally speaking, these actions would be roundly condemned. It's inexcusable. Newspapers and magazines would have a field day over it, and your company's reputation would suffer.
I'm sure you understand this very well, Mr. Komatsu.
We know all the facts, and have incontrovertible proof we can reveal to the world. So it's best not to try to talk your way out of it.
It's a waste of time for both of us.
Komatsu nodded.
If it did come to that, obviously you would have to resign from the company. Plus, you know that you would be blackballed from the field. There would be no place left for you in publishing. For legitimate work, at least.
I imagine not, Komatsu said. But at this point, only a limited number of people know the truth, Buzzcut said. You, Eriko Fukada, Professor Ebisuno, and Tengo Kawana, who rewrote the book, and just a handful of others.
Komatsu chose his words carefully.
According to our working hypothesis, this handful of others would be members of Sakigake.
Buzzcut nodded, barely.
Yes, according to our hypothesis, that would be the case.
Buzzcut paused, allowing the hypothesis to sink in, and then he went on.
And if that hypothesis is indeed true, then they can do whatever they want to you. They can keep you here as their guest of honor for as long as they like. No problem at all. Or if they wanted to shorten the length of your stay, there are any number of other choices they can make, including ones that would be unpleasant for both sides. Either way, they have the power and the means. I believe you already have a pretty good grasp of that.
I think I do, Komatsu replied.
Good, Buzzcut said.
Buzzcut raised a finger, and Ponytail left the room. He soon returned with a phone. He plugged it into a jack on the wall and handed the phone to Komatsu. Buzzcut directed him to call his company.
You have had a terrible cold and a fever and have been in bed for a few days. It doesn't look like you'll be able to come into work for a while. Tell them that, and then hang up.
Komatsu asked for one of his colleagues, briefly explained what he had to say, and hung up without responding to his questions. Buzzcut nodded, and Ponytail unplugged the phone from the jack and took the phone and left the room. Buzzcut intently studied the back of his hands, then turned to Komatsu. There was a faint tinge of kindness in his voice.
That's it for today, he said. We'll talk again another day. Until then, please consider carefully what we have discussed.
The two of them left, and Komatsu spent the next 10 days in silence in that room. 3 times a day, the masked young man would bring in the mediocre meals. After the 4th day, Komatsu was given a change of clothes, a cotton pajama-like top and bottom. But until the very end, they didn't let him take a shower. The most he could do was wash his face in the tiny sink attached to the toilet. His sense of time's passage grew more uncertain. Komatsu thought that he had been taken to the cult's headquarters in Yamanashi. He had seen it on TV. It was deep in the mountains, surrounded by a tall fence, like some independent realm. Escape, or finding help, was out of the question. If they did end up killing him, which must be what they had meant by an unpleasant choice, his body would never be found. He had never felt death so real or so close. 10 days after he had made that forced call to his company, most likely 10 days, though he wouldn't bet on it, the same duo made another appearance. Buzzcut seemed thinner than before, which made his cheekbones all the more prominent. His cold eyes were now bloodshot. As before, he sat down on the folding chair he had brought, across the table from Komatsu. He didn't say a word for a long time. He simply stared at Komatsu with his red eyes. Ponytail looked the same. Again he stood, ramrod straight, in front of the door, his emotionless eyes fixed on an imaginary point in space. They were again dressed in black trousers and white shirts, most likely a sort of uniform.
"Let's pick up where we left off last time," Buzzcut finally said. "We were saying that we can do whatever we like with you."
Komatsu nodded. "Including choices that wouldn't be pleasant for either side."
"You really do have a great memory," Buzzcut said. "You are correct. An unpleasant outcome is looming."
Komatsu was silent. Buzzcut went on.
"In theory, that is. Practically speaking, they would much prefer not to make an extreme choice. If you were suddenly to disappear now, Mr. Komatsu, that would lead to unwanted complications, just like it did when Eriko Fukada disappeared. There aren't many people who would be sad if you were gone, but you're a respected editor, prominent in your field, and I'm sure that if you fall behind in your alimony payments, your wife will have something to say about it. For them, this would not be a very favorable development. Komatsu gave a dry cough and swallowed. They're not criticizing you personally or trying to punish you. They understand that in publishing Air Chrysalis, you weren't intending to attack a specific religious organization. At first, you didn't even know the connection between the novel and that organization. You perpetrated this fraud for fun and out of ambition. And money became a factor, too, as things developed. It's very hard for a mere company employee to pay alimony and child support, isn't it? And you brought Tengo Kawana, an aspiring novelist and cram school instructor who didn't know anything about the circumstances, into the mix. The plan itself was smart, but your choice of the novel and the writer, not so much. And things got more complicated than you imagined. You were like ordinary citizens who had wandered across the front lines and stepped into a minefield. You can't go forward, and you can't go back. Am I correct in this, Mr. Komatsu? That might sum it up, I suppose, Komatsu replied. There still seem to be some things you don't entirely understand, Buzzcut said, his eyes narrowing a fraction. If you did, you wouldn't pretend that this has nothing to do with you. Let's make things crystal clear. You are, frankly, in the middle of a minefield. Komatsu silently nodded. Buzzcut closed his eyes and 10 seconds later opened them. The situation has put you in a bind, but understand that it has created some real problems for them as well. Komatsu took the plunge and spoke. Do you mind if I ask you a question? If it's something I can answer. By publishing Air Chrysalis, we created a little trouble for the religious organization. Is that what you're saying? More than a little trouble, Buzzcut said. He grimaced slightly. The voice no longer speaks to them. Do you have any idea what that means? No, Komatsu croaked, his voice dry. Fine. I can't explain any more to you than that. And it's better for you not to know. The voice no longer speaks to them. That's all I can tell you now. Buzzcut paused. And this unhappy turn of events was brought about by the publication of Air Chrysalis. Komatsu posed a question. And did Eriko Fukada and Professor Ebisuno expect that by making Air Chrysalis public, they would bring about this unhappy turn of events? Buzzcut shook his head. No, I don't think Professor Ebisuno knew things would turn out this way. It's unclear what Eriko Fukada's intentions were. Saying it was unintentional is just conjecture. But even if you assume it was intentional, I don't believe it was her intention. People read Air Chrysalis as a fantasy novel, Komatsu said. A harmless, dreamy little tale written by a high school girl. Actually, the novel was criticized quite a lot for being a bit too surreal. No one ever suspected that some great secret or concrete information was exposed in the pages of the book. I imagine you're right, Buzzcut said. The vast majority of people would never notice. But that's not the issue. Those secrets should never have been made public, in any form whatsoever. Ponytail stood rooted to a spot in front of the door, staring at the wall, at some prospect that no one else could see. What they want is to get the voice back, Buzzcut said, choosing his words. The well hasn't run dry. It has just sunk deeper, where it can't be seen. It will be quite difficult to restore, but it can be done. Buzzcut looked deep into Komatsu's eyes. He looked like he was measuring the depths of something inside, like eyeballing a room to see if a piece of furniture would fit. As I said earlier, all of you have wandered into a minefield. You can't go forward, and you can't go back.
What they can do is show you the path, so you can get out safely. If they do, you'll have a narrow escape, and they'll peacefully manage to get rid of some bothersome intruders. Buzzcut folded his arms. We would like you to quietly withdraw from all this. They aren't really concerned if you leave here in one piece, but it will present problems if we make a lot of noise here right now. So, Mr. Komatsu, I will show you the way to retreat. I will guide you back to a safe place. What I ask for in return is the following. You must stop publishing Air Chrysalis. You won't print any more copies or reprint it in paperback, and all advertising for the book will cease. And you will sever all connections with Eriko Fukada. What do you say? You have enough influence to handle that. It won't be easy, but maybe I can manage it, Komatsu said. Mr. Komatsu, we didn't bring you all the way here to talk about maybes. Buzzcut's eyes grew even redder and sharper. We're not asking you to collect all the copies of the book that are out there. Do that, and the media would jump on the story. And we know your influence doesn't extend that far. We would just like you to quietly take care of things. We can't undo what has already happened. Once something's ruined, it can't go back to the way it was. What they would like is to remove this from the spotlight. Do you follow me? Komatsu nodded. Mr. Komatsu, as I have explained, there are several facts here that must not come to light. If they did, all those involved would suffer repercussions. So, for the sake of both parties, we would like to conclude a truce. They will not hold you responsible beyond this point. Peace will be guaranteed. You will have nothing further to do with Air Chrysalis. This isn't such a bad deal, you know. Komatsu thought it over. All right, I will begin by making sure Air Chrysalis is no longer published. It may take some time, but I'll find a way. And speaking personally, I can put this entire matter out of my mind. I think Tengo Kawana can do the same. He wasn't enthusiastic about it from the very beginning. I got him involved against his will. His role in this is long past. And I don't think Eriko Fukada will be a problem. She said that she doesn't plan to write any more novels. Professor Ebisuno is the only one whose reaction I can't gauge. Ultimately, he wanted to determine if his friend Tamotsu Fukada was all right. He wants to know where he is now and what he's doing. Whatever I might tell him, he may continue to pursue information on Mr. Fukada. Tamotsu Fukada is dead, Buzzcut said. His voice was quiet, uninflected, but there was something terribly heavy within. Dead? Komatsu asked. It happened recently, Buzzcut said. He took a deep breath and slowly exhaled. He died of a heart attack. It was over in a moment, and he didn't suffer. Due to the circumstances, we didn't submit a notification of death, and we held the funeral secretly at our compound. For religious reasons, the body was incinerated, the bones crushed and sprinkled in the nearby mountains. Legally, this constitutes desecration of a body, but it would be difficult to make a formal case against us. But this is the truth. We never lie when it comes to matters of life and death. I would like you to let Professor Ebisuno know about this. A natural death. Buzzcut nodded deeply. Mr. Fukada was a very important person for us. No. Important is too trite a term to express what he was. He was a giant. His death has only been reported to a limited number of people. They grieved deeply for the loss. His wife, Eriko Fukada's mother, died several years ago of stomach cancer. She refused chemotherapy and passed away within our treatment facility. Her husband, Tamotsu, cared for her to the end. Even so, you didn't file a notification of her death, Komatsu asked. No words of denial came. And Tamotsu Fukada passed away recently. Correct, Buzzcut said. Was this after Air Chrysalis was published? Buzzcut's gaze went down to the table for a moment,
Then he raised his head and looked at Komatsu.
That's right. Mr. Fukada passed away after Air Chrysalis was published.
Are the two events related? Komatsu dared to ask.
Buzzcut didn't say anything for a while, pondering how he should respond. Finally, as if he made up his mind, he spoke.
Fine. I think it might be best to let Professor Ebisuno know all the facts, so he will understand. Mr. Tamotsu Fukada was the real leader, the one who hears the voice. When his daughter, Eriko Fukada, published Air Chrysalis, the voice stopped speaking to him, and at that point Mr. Fukada himself put an end to his existence. It was a natural death. More precisely, he put an end to his own existence naturally.
Eriko Fukada was the daughter of leader, Komatsu murmured.
Buzzcut gave a concise, abbreviated nod.
And Eriko Fukada ended up driving her father to his death, Komatsu continued.
Buzzcut nodded once more.
That is correct.
But the religion still continues to exist.
The religion does still exist, Buzzcut replied,
and he stared at Komatsu with eyes like ancient pebbles frozen deep within a glacier.
Mr. Komatsu, the publication of Air Chrysalis has done more than a little damage to Sakigake. However, they are not thinking to punish you for this. There is nothing to be gained from punishing you at this point. They have a mission they must accomplish, and in order to do so, quiet isolation is required.
So you want everyone to take a step back and forget it all happened?
In a word, yes.
Was it absolutely necessary to kidnap me in order to get this message across?
Something akin to an expression crossed Buzzcut's face for the first time. A superficial emotion, located somewhere in the interstice between humor and sympathy.
They went to the trouble of bringing you here, because they wanted you to understand the seriousness of the situation. They didn't want to do anything drastic, but if something is necessary, they don't hesitate. They wanted you to really feel this, viscerally. If all of you do not keep your promise, then something quite unpleasant will occur. Do you follow me?
I do, Komatsu replied.
To tell you the truth, Mr. Komatsu, you were very fortunate. Because of all the heavy fog, you may not have noticed this, but you were just a few inches from the edge of a cliff. It would be best if you remember this. At the moment, they do not have the freedom to deal with you. There are many more pressing matters at hand. And in that sense, too, you are quite fortunate. So while this good fortune still continues...
As he said this, he turned his palms face up, like someone checking to see if it was raining. Komatsu waited for his next words, but there weren't any. Now that he had finished speaking, Buzzcut looked exhausted. He slowly rose from his chair, folded it, and exited the cube-shaped room without so much as a glance back. The heavy door closed, the lock clicking shut. Komatsu was left all alone.
They kept me locked away in that square little room for 4 more days. We had already discussed what was important. They had told me what they wanted to say, and we had come to an agreement, so I couldn't see the point of keeping me there any longer. That duo never appeared again, and the young man in charge of me never uttered a word. I ate the same monotonous food, shaved with the electric razor, and spent my time staring at the ceiling and the walls. I slept when they turned off the lights, woke up when they switched them on, and I pondered what Buzzcut had told me. What really struck me was the fact that he said, "We were fortunate." Buzzcut was right. If these guys wanted to, they could do anything they wanted. They could be as cold-blooded as they liked. While I was locked up in there, I really came to believe this. I think they must have kept me locked up for 4 more days, knowing that would be the result. They don't miss a beat. They're very meticulous.
Komatsu picked up his glass and took a sip of the highball.
They drugged me again, with chloroform or whatever, and when I woke up it was daybreak, and I was lying on a bench in Jingu Gaien. It was the end of September, and the mornings were cold. Thanks to this I actually did wind up with a cold and a fever, and I really was in bed for the next 3 days.
but I guess I should consider myself fortunate if that's the worst thing that happened to me.
Komatsu seemed to be finished with his story.
Did you tell this to Professor Ebisuno?
Tengo asked.
Yes, after I was released, and a few days after my fever broke, I went to his house on the mountain. I told him pretty much what I told you.
What was his reaction?
Komatsu drained the last drop of his highball and ordered a refill. He urged Tengo to do the same, but Tengo shook his head.
Professor Ebisuno had me repeat the story over and over, and asked a lot of detailed questions. I answered whatever I could. I could repeat the same story as many times as he wished. I mean, after I last spoke with Buzzcut, I was locked up alone for 4 days in that room. I had nobody to talk to, and plenty of time on my hands. So I went over what he had told me, and was able to accurately remember all the details, like I was a human tape recorder.
But the part about Fuka Eri's parents dying was just something they claimed happened, right?
Tengo asked.
That's right. They insisted it happened, but there's no way to verify it. They didn't file a death notice. Still, considering the way Buzzcut sounded, it didn't seem like he was making it up. As he said, Sakigake considers people's lives and deaths a sacred thing. After I finished my story, Professor Ebisuno was silent for a time, thinking it over. He really thinks about things deeply for a long time. Without a word, he stood up, left the room, and didn't come back for quite a while. I think he was trying to accept his friend's deaths, trying to understand them as inevitable. He may have already half expected that they were no longer of the world and had resigned himself to that fact. Still, actually being told that two close friends have died has got to hurt.
Tengo remembered the bare, Spartan living room, the chilly, deep silence, the occasional sharp call of a bird outside the window.
So, he asked, have we actually backed our way out of the minefield?
A fresh highball was brought over. Komatsu took a sip.
No conclusion was reached right then. Professor Ebisuno said he needed time to think. But what other choice do we have than to do what they told us? I got things rolling right away. At first, I did everything I could and stopped them from printing additional copies of Air Chrysalis. So, in effect, it's out of print. There will be no paperback edition, either. The book already sold a lot of copies and made the company plenty of money, so they won't suffer a loss. In a large company like this, you have to have meetings about it. The president has to sign off on it. But when I dangled before them the prospect of a scandal connected with a ghostwriter, the higher-ups were terrified, and in the end they did what I wanted. It looks like I'll be given the silent treatment from now on, but it's okay. I'm used to it.
Did Professor Ebisuno accept what they said about Fuka Eri's parents being dead?
I think so, Komatsu said. But I imagine it will take some time for it to really sink in, for him to fully accept it. As far as I could tell, those guys were serious. They would make a few concessions, but I think they're hoping to avoid any more trouble, which is why they resorted to kidnapping. They wanted to make absolutely sure we got the message. And they didn't need to tell me about how they secretly incinerated the bodies of Mr. and Mrs. Fukada. Even though it would be hard to prove, desecration of bodies is a major crime. But still, they brought it up. They laid their cards on the table. That's why I think most of what Buzzcut told me was the truth. Maybe not every detail, but the overall picture at least.
Tengo went over what Komatsu had told him. Fuka Eri's father was the one who heard the voice. A prophet, in other words. But when his daughter published Air Chrysalis and it became a bestseller, the voice stopped speaking to him, and as a result the father died a natural death.
Or rather, he put an end to his own existence naturally, Komatsu said.
And so it's critical for Sakigake to gain a new prophet. If the voice stops speaking, then the religion's whole reason for existence is lost. So they don't have the time to worry about the likes of us. In a nutshell, that's the story, right?
I think so.
Air Chrysalis contains information of critical importance to them. When it was published and became widely read, the voice went silent. But what critical information could the book be pointing toward?
During those last 4 days of my confinement, I thought a lot about that, Komatsu said. Air Chrysalis is a pretty short novel. In the story, the world is filled with little people. The 10-year-old girl, who is the protagonist, lives in an isolated community. The little people secretly come out at night and create an air chrysalis.
The girl's alter ego is inside the chrysalis, and a mother-daughter relationship is formed, the Maza and the Dota. There are two moons in that world, a large one and a small one, probably symbolizing the Maza and the Dota. In the novel, the protagonist, based on Fuka Eri herself, I think, rejects being a Maza and runs away from the community. The Dota is left behind. The novel doesn't tell us what happened to the Dota after that. Tengo stared for a time at the ice melting in his glass. I wonder if the one who hears the voice needs the Dota as an intermediary, Tengo said. It's through her that he can hear the voice for the first time, or perhaps through her that the voice is translated into comprehensible language. Both of them have to be there for the message of the voice to take its proper form. To borrow Fuka Eri's terms, there's a receiver and a perceiver. But first of all, the air chrysalis has to be created, because the Dota can only be born through it. And to create a Dota, the proper Maza must be there. That's your opinion, Tengo. Tengo shook his head. I wouldn't call it an opinion. As I listened to you summarize the plot, I thought that must be the way it is. As he rewrote the novel and afterward, Tengo had pondered the meaning of the Maza and the Dota, but he was never quite able to grasp the overall picture. But now, as he talked with Komatsu, the pieces gradually fell into place. Though he still had questions. Why did an air chrysalis materialize above his father's bed in the hospital? And why was Aomame, as a young girl, inside? It's a fascinating system, Komatsu said, but isn't it a problem for the Maza to be separated from the Dota? Without the Dota, it's hard to see the Maza as a complete entity. As we saw with Fuka Eri, it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what that means. But there is something missing, like a person who has lost his shadow. What the Dota is like without the Maza, I have no idea. Probably they're both incomplete, because ultimately the Dota is nothing more than an alter ego. But in Fuka Eri's case, even without the Maza by her side, the Dota may have been able to fulfill her role as a kind of medium. Komatsu's lips were stretched in a tight line for a while, then turned up slightly. Are you thinking that everything in Air Chrysalis really took place? I'm not saying that. I'm just making an assumption, hypothesizing that it's all real, and going from there. All right, Komatsu said. So even if Fuka Eri's alter ego goes far away from her body, she can still function as a medium. Which explains why Sakigake isn't forcing her to return, even if they know her whereabouts. Because in her case, even if the Maza isn't nearby, the Dota can still fulfill her duties. Maybe their connection is that strong, even if they're far apart. Okay. Tengo continued. I imagine that they have multiple Dotas. The little people must use the chance to create many air chrysalises. They would be anxious if all they had was one perceiver. Or the number of Dotas who can function correctly might be limited. Maybe there is one powerful main Dota and several weaker auxiliary Dotas, and they function collectively. So the Dota that Fuka Eri left behind was the main Dota, the one who functions properly? That seems possible. Throughout everything that has happened, Fuka Eri has always been at the center, like the eye of a hurricane. Komatsu narrowed his eyes and folded his hands together on the table. When he wanted to, he could really focus on an issue. You know, Tengo, I was thinking about this. Couldn't you hypothesize that the Fuka Eri we met is actually the Dota, and what was left behind at Sakigake was the Maza? This came as a bit of a shock. The idea had never occurred to Tengo. For him, Fuka Eri was an actual person. But put it that way, and it started to sound possible. I have no periods, so there's no chance I'll get pregnant. Fuka Eri had announced this after they had had intercourse that night. If she was nothing more than an alter ego, her inability to get pregnant would make sense. An alter ego can't reproduce itself. Only the Maza can do it. Still, Tengo couldn't accept that hypothesis, that it was possible he had had intercourse with her alter ego, not the real Fuka Eri. Fuka Eri has a distinct personality and her own code of conduct. I sort of doubt an alter ego could have those. Exactly, Komatsu agreed,
If she has nothing else, Fukaeri does have her own distinct personality and code of conduct. I would have to agree with you on that one. Still, Fukaeri was hiding a secret, a critical code hidden away inside this lovely girl. A code he had to crack. Tengo sensed this. Which one was the real person, and which one the alter ego? Or was the whole notion of classifying into real and alter ego a mistake? Maybe Fukaeri was able, depending on the situation, to manipulate both her real self and her alter ego. There are several things I still don't understand, Komatsu said, resting his hands on the table and staring at them. For a middle-aged man, his fingers were long and slender. The voice has stopped speaking. The water in the well has dried up. The prophet has died. What will happen to the Dota after that? She won't follow him in death, like widows do in India. When there's no more receiver, there's no need for a perceiver. If we take your hypothesis a step further, that is, Komatsu said. Did Fukaeri know that would be the result when she wrote Air Chrysalis? That Sakigake man told me it wasn't intentional. At least, it wasn't her intention. But how could he know this? I don't know, Tengo said. But I just can't see Fukaeri intentionally driving her father to his death. I think her father was facing death for some other reason. Maybe that's why she left in the first place. Or maybe she was hoping that her father would be freed from the voice. I'm just speculating, though, and I have nothing to back it up. Komatsu considered this for a long time, wrinkles forming on either side of his nose. Finally, he sighed and glanced around. What a strange world. With each passing day, it's getting harder to know how much is just hypothetical and how much is real. Tell me, Tengo, as a novelist, what is your definition of reality? When you prick a person with a needle, red blood comes out. That's the real world, Tengo replied. Then this is most definitely the real world, Komatsu said, and he rubbed his inner forearm. Pale veins rose to the surface. They were not very healthy-looking blood vessels damaged by years of drinking, smoking, an unhealthy lifestyle, and various literary intrigues. Komatsu drained the last of his highball and clinked the ice around in the empty glass. Could you go on with your hypothesis? It's getting more interesting. They are looking for a successor to the one who hears the voice, Tengo said. But they also have to find a new, properly functional Dota. A new receiver will need a new perceiver. In other words, they need to find a new Maza as well. And in order to do so, they have to make a new Air Chrysalis. That sounds like a pretty large-scale operation, which is why they're so deadly serious. Exactly. But they can't be going about this blind, Tengo said. They've got to have somebody in mind. Komatsu nodded. I got that impression, too. That's why they wanted to get rid of us as fast as they could, so we don't bother them anymore. I think we were quite a blot on their personal landscape. How so? Komatsu shook his head. He didn't know either. I wonder what message the voice told them until now, and what connection there is between the voice and the little people. Komatsu shook his head listlessly again. This, too, went beyond anything the two of them could imagine. Did you see the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey? I did, Tengo said. We're like the apes in the movie, Komatsu said. The ones with shaggy black fur, screeching out some nonsense as they dance around the monolith. A new pair of customers came into the bar, sat down at the counter like they were regulars, and ordered cocktails. There's one thing we can say for sure, Komatsu said, sounding like he wanted to wind things down. Your hypothesis is convincing. It makes sense. I always really enjoy having these talks with you, but we're going to back out of this scary minefield and probably never see Fukaeri or Professor Ebisuno again. Air Chrysalis is nothing more than a harmless fantasy novel with not a single piece of concrete information in it, and what that voice is and what message it's transmitting have nothing to do with us. We need to leave it that way. Get off the boat and get back to life on shore. Komatsu nodded. You got it. I'll go to work every day, gathering manuscripts that don't make a difference one way or another in order to publish them in a literary journal. You will go to cram school and teach math to promising young people, and in between teaching, you'll write novels.
We'll each go back to our own peaceful, mundane lives. No rapids, no waterfalls. We'll quietly grow old. Any objection? We don't have any other choice, do we?
Komatsu stretched out the wrinkles next to his nose with his finger.
That's right. We have no other choice. I can tell you this. I don't want to ever be kidnapped again. Being locked up in that room once is more than enough. If there were a next time, I might not see the light of day. Just the thought of meeting that duo again makes my heart quake. They only need to glare at you, and you would keel over.
Komatsu turned to face the bar and signaled with his glass for a third highball. He stuck a fresh cigarette in his mouth.
But why haven't you told me this until now? It has been quite some time since the kidnapping, over 2 months. You should have told me earlier.
I don't know, Komatsu said, slightly inclining his head.
You're right. I was thinking I should tell you, but I kept putting it off. I'm not sure why. Maybe I had a guilty conscience.
Guilty conscience? Tengo said, surprised. He had never expected to hear Komatsu say that.
Even I can have a guilty conscience, Komatsu said.
About what?
Komatsu didn't reply. He narrowed his eyes and rolled the unlit cigarette around between his lips.
Does Fukaeri know her parents have died? Tengo asked.
I think she probably does. I imagine at some point Professor Ebisuno told her about it.
Tengo nodded. Fukaeri must have known about it a long time ago. He had a distinct feeling she did. He was the only one who hadn't been told.
So we get out of the boat and return to our lives on shore, Tengo repeated.
That's right. We edge away from the minefield. But even if we want to do that, do you think we can go back to our old lives that easily?
All we can do is try, Komatsu said. He struck a match and lit the cigarette.
What specifically bothers you?
Lots of things around us are already starting to fall into strange patterns. Some things have already been transformed, and it may not be easy for them to go back the way they were.
Even if our lives are on the line.
Tengo gave an ambiguous shake of his head. He had been feeling for some time that he was caught up in a strong current, one that never wavered, and that current was dragging him off to some unknown place. But he couldn't really explain it to Komatsu.
Tengo didn't reveal to Komatsu that the novel he was writing now carried on the world in Air Chrysalis. Komatsu probably wouldn't welcome the news, and Sakigake would certainly be less than pleased. If he wasn't careful, he might step into a different minefield, or get the people around him mixed up in it. But a narrative takes its own direction and continues on almost automatically, and whether he liked it or not, Tengo was a part of that world. To him, this was no longer a fictional world. This was the real world, where red blood spurts out when you slice open your skin with a knife. And in the sky in this world, there were two moons, side by side.
Chapter 19. Ushikawa. What he can do that most people can't. It was a quiet, windless Thursday morning. Ushikawa woke, as usual, before six and washed his face with cold water. He brushed his teeth as he listened to the NHK news on the radio, and he shaved with the electric razor. He boiled water in a pot, made instant ramen, and after he finished eating, drank a cup of instant coffee. He rolled up his sleeping bag, stowed it in the closet, and sat down at the window in front of his camera. The eastern sky was beginning to grow light. It looked like it was going to be a warm day. The faces of all the people who left for work in the morning were etched in his mind. There was no need to take any more photos. From 7 to 8:30, they hurried out of the apartment building to the station, the usual suspects. Ushikawa heard the lively voices of a group of elementary school pupils heading off for school. The children's voices reminded him of when his daughters were little. His daughters had thoroughly enjoyed elementary school. They took piano and ballet lessons and had lots of friends. To the very end, Ushikawa had found it hard to accept that he had these ordinary, happy kids. How could someone like him possibly be the father of children like these? After the morning rush, almost no one came in or out of the building. The children's lively voices had disappeared. Ushikawa laid aside the remote control for the shutter, leaned against the wall, smoked a cigarette, and kept an eye on the entrance through a gap in the curtain. As always, just after 10 a.m., the mailman came on his small red motorcycle and adeptly sorted the mail into the boxes. From what Ushikawa could make out, half of it was junk mail, stuff that would be tossed away unopened. As the sun rose higher, the temperature went up, and most of the people along the street took off their coats. It was after 11 when Fuka Eri appeared at the entrance to the building. She wore the same black turtleneck as before, a gray short coat, jeans, sneakers, and dark sunglasses, and an oversized green shoulder bag slung diagonally across her shoulder. The bag was bulging with, no doubt, all sorts of things. Ushikawa left the wall he was leaning against, went over to the camera on the tripod, and squinted through the viewfinder. The girl was leaving there. That much he understood. She had stuffed all her belongings in that bag and was setting off for somewhere else. She would never be back there again. He could sense it. Maybe she decided to leave here, he thought, because she noticed I was staking out the place. The thought made his heart race. As she stepped out of the entrance, she came to a halt and stared up at the sky like she had done before, searching for something among the tangle of electric lines and the transformers. Her sunglasses caught the light and glittered. Had she found what she was looking for? Or maybe not. He couldn't read her expression through the sunglasses. She must have stood there, frozen, for a good 30 seconds, gazing up at the sky. Then, almost as an afterthought, she turned her head and looked straight at the window behind which Ushikawa was hiding. She took off her sunglasses and stuck them in a coat pocket. She frowned and focused her gaze right on the camouflage telephoto lens. She knows, Ushikawa thought once again. The girl knows I'm hiding in here, that she's being secretly watched. And she was looking at him in the opposite direction, watching Ushikawa through the lens and back through the viewfinder, like water flowing backward through a curved pipe. Ushikawa felt the flesh crawl on both his arms. Fuka Eri blinked every few moments. Like independent, silent, living creatures, her eyelids slowly went up and down in a studied way. Nothing else moved. She stood there like some lofty bird, with neck twisted, staring straight at Ushikawa. He couldn't pull his eyes away from her. It felt as if the entire world had come to a momentary halt. There was no wind, and sounds no longer made the air vibrate. Finally, Fuka Eri stopped looking at him. She raised her head again and gazed up at the sky as she had done a moment before. This time, though, she stopped after a couple of seconds. Her expression was unchanged. She took the dark sunglasses out of her pocket, put them on again, and headed toward the street. She walked with a smooth, unhesitant stride. I should go out and follow her. Tengu isn't back yet, and I have the time to find out where she's going. Couldn't hurt to find out where she's moving to. But somehow Ushikawa couldn't stand up from the floor. His body was numb. That sharp gaze she had sent through the viewfinder had robbed him of the strength he needed to take action. It's okay, Ushikawa told himself as he sat there on the floor. Aomame is the only one I have to locate. Eriko Fukada is a fascinating girl, but she's not my main priority here. She's just a supporting actress. If she's leaving, why not just let her go? Once on the main street, Fuka Eri hurried off toward the station. She didn't look back. Through the gap in the sun-bleached curtains, Ushikawa watched as she went. Once the green shoulder bag, swinging back and forth, disappeared from view, he practically crawled away from the camera and leaned against the wall again, waiting for his strength to return. He took out a 7 Stars, lit it, and inhaled the smoke deeply. But the cigarette was tasteless. His strength didn't return. His arms and legs still felt numb. He suddenly realized a strange space had formed inside him, a kind of pure hollow. The space signified a simple lack, a nothingness. Ushikawa sat there in the midst of this unknown void, unable to rise. He felt a dull pain in his chest. Not exactly pain,